Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. And, of course, don't forget my latest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions, with its whole new theory about the biological origin of these emotions, how they functioned over a million years of evolution, and how we can overcome their legacy, what I call their negative legacy effects. And also, on my website, if you go just to the top selected highlights, you'll find a link also to an article on the subject that I published recently in Medical Hypotheses. The coming week is going to have some interesting stuff going on in Europe, folks. I'm going to be in Denmark by Skype at an important conference, which will have, I'm going to be live on Skype, which will also have in person people like Robert Whitaker, whom probably almost all of you know, and and Peter Goetsche, who some of you may not know, who is becoming one of the very best researchers in this whole field of psychiatry. You can find out about the Danish program, which I think still has some spots. You can find out about it on September 16th by going to my website again, bregan.com, and again to selected highlights, and you'll find an announcement about that meeting. That's on the 16th in Copenhagen. And the 18th, I'll be Skyping into a similar and wonderful conference in London, which I think you'll... I don't have that data right in front of me, but you can probably get it on Google, and it's in London. But I know they have spaces in Copenhagen, so go, folks. Anybody in Europe, go to Copenhagen, that wonderful place, and see a great conference. My guest today, hi, Rebecca, you there?
Yes, hi, Peter.
Hi. Rebecca Hatton... she's a PsyD, which has clinical practice of psychotherapy. I heard about Rebecca from the best possible source, Burke Caron, who is the wonderful professor emeritus from Michigan State, whom I have known for years. And when he and I are at conferences together, which I try to arrange often, we sit and we talk for a couple hours, and people love it, just about doing therapy. Well, Bert recommended Rebecca Hatton to me, and she says that she's been trained by Bert in psychodynamic approaches to psychosis. She is one of the few therapists that I can have on the air who takes the risk of working a lot with psychotic patients. I think this is going to be really interesting in terms of what is it like to work with people who have lost touch with reality, as we understand reality, and as most folks do. She has had a training as in the first training group of the Finnish Open Dialogue, which is a family-oriented intervention in Lapland that has, I've mentioned before, that has... really transformed, and with statistical data to prove it, interventions into people who are having their initial psychosis. And we're going to talk about that, about the remarkable effects that they've had, practically wiping out so-called schizophrenia in Lapland because the patients don't stay out of touch long enough to fit the diagnosis. There's a lot more I could say about Rebecca, but she did a great presentation at our conference in Michigan State. So, hey, folks, welcome Rebecca Hatton Psy-D to the show. Hi, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's great to be able to talk about dialogue. It's I could probably talk all day about what, you know, it's been only 4 years since I started training in it, since I first heard of it, actually. It's just been a few years, and it has been really an eye-opening and kind of a transformative process for me professionally and personally as well. So it's, you know, it's great to be able to talk about it with like-minded people. I think, you know, you mentioned the outcomes just briefly, and that is the reason that we are so interested in dialogue, and because it reliably and very consistently, since the time it was first implemented 20-plus years ago, has reduced the prevalence, the population prevalence of what we call schizophrenia, you know, DSM schizophrenia in the province of Western Lapland in Finland by 80% or more. And these are people who don't meet the diagnostic criteria. They don't relapse. They sort of get through the crisis, and by in dialogue and with their network, their social network around them, are able to kind of dissolve the crisis and come back into consensus dialogue with people. And this is without, you know, using medication. When dialogue was first put together, it was part of a multi-site Scandinavian project. You know, we're always looking for ways to sort of bring everything we know together. We've known for decades a lot about how to help people, even with, you know, very severe emotional difficulties. And where somebody is often, you know, trying to sort of put together a package that will be optimal. And so in the mid-80s, this was done at several sites across Scandinavia, and dialogue in Tornio in Western Lapland was one of these sites. The one difference in the approach that the Finnish team used was that they did not prescribe medications across the board. That was not their frontline, a part of their treatment from the beginning. All the other sites integrated medication, neuroleptics, with their, you know, the rest of their array. And the Finnish group ended up with by far the best outcomes. And so this, you know, dialogue is very often managed without use of medication, restraint, any coercive input, whatever you call that, and has the, you know, the good results. So that is why, you know, when I first heard about the training, I had this compulsion. I was like, I have to do this. I have to have this training. I felt this a real draw. I was very much drawn to the training. Is carried out by a team with the American Mary Olson, who's a psychologist in Massachusetts, who put together a training institute with Jaakko Seikkula, who is the first author on much of the outcome research in Finland, and a couple of other European colleagues.
Rebecca, spell his name, because as you know, if people just Google his name, they're going to get a lot of scientific articles on this.
Yes, they have published probably over 24 articles about their outcomes, and you can find that by Googling Jaakko Seikkula. which is spelled J-A-A-K-K-O, and Seikula is S-E-I-K-K-U-L-A. So,
good.
Yes, go ahead.
No, that's just fine. Probably J. Sekula would probably get you there, too. J period. And again, it's S-E-I-K-K-U-L-A, right?
Yes, S is in Sam, E-I-K-K-U-L-A. And Sekula is not an uncommon name in Finnish, but Jaakko Seikkula, and also Open Dialogue, and you should be able to get to a lot of resources. There's a film, a documentary on YouTube in full now. Daniel Mackler went to Finland in 2009 and interviewed a lot of the people doing this work, including Jaakko, along with Bob Whitaker, and you know, so that is also very helpful just to get a bit of an idea of the impact that that dialogue has, a little bit about what it's like. Because it is some of it is counterintuitive, you know, it's a bit very different from our usual approach to, you know, people who are really suffering these kinds of dilemmas.
Well, you know, I've been interested in the family therapy approach, which this is essentially. Since my training, I was I think even as an intern, I was the first psychiatrist in the State University of New York Upstate Medical Center ever to just bring families together, because as this group says, as the Open Dialogue group says very interestingly, schizophrenia lies in between the family members.
Yes.
Something about that goes on in between the members. And that just tells you that whatever the cause, the healing can be best facilitated by what happens in between the family members.
Yeah.
Let's get a little more specific so that people understand what this program is about. Just briefly, and Rebecca, tell me if I'm right. In Finland, the families pretty much know all about these programs, and if somebody is having a psychotic break, some youngster is starting to hear things or see things or, you know, completely withdraw, they get right in touch with the Open Dialogue. And the Open Dialogue invites them to come into the clinic if they want, but that they would like to see them in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And they go with several professionals, not just one. I think what I saw in the films and so on, they sent two or three different kinds of professionals in because it's not easy to deal with the families, and also because they want to make clear this isn't one professional telling you the truth. And then they have an open dialogue between the family, among the family members and the professionals, about what's going on in the family, and I presume with an underlying theme of how are we going to heal this and make communication better. And they rarely, they don't just start you on meds. They actually don't start people on meds immediately. They will go to a benzodiazepine to help with sleep, which I will very, very occasionally do. And that'd be their first line. And then if they go to neuroleptics, antipsychotics, they do a very small percentage of people, and they get them off as soon as they can. And it's those people who they can get off, which is, well, not start at all, which is like 80% or so of the folks, or 90%, they do very, very well, and they don't even get a diagnosis of schizophrenia. Is that a fair summary?
Well, the work with it really has become embedded in the wider culture, dialogical approach, so that people do contact services very early. I mean, the level of trust of families that they won't be blamed or judged, that they won't be labeled and segregated, excluded, you know, all of that is, it's known. It's, you know, so many people just in the general public have been part of dialogues, because not just the family, but sometimes the employer or teacher or friends will be included in the meetings. So that, you know, Jaakko told us he thinks at least half of the population of Lapland has been part of dialogue process at some point. And so the trust is very high, in contrast to the relationship between professions, mental health professions here, and people and families that are experiencing, you know, serious problems. People now are contacting services within days or a few weeks of first having, you know, unusual experiences. So, and the method is very open and accepting and welcoming, and strives to hear every voice, to hear, to welcome, you know, no matter how angry or how much in pain or how difficult to understand or comprehend, all the voices. And, you know, we all have multiple voices inside of ourselves. So, you know, there can be lots of sides to the conversation, but the goal is to have as open a conversation as possible, as welcoming, and, you know, looking for understanding that the good intentions that lie behind some real difficulties and dilemmas and so on, so that, you know, people do feel comfortable calling and asking, even to have the team come into their home. You know, this is something that a lot of Americans, I think, would find quite intrusive, and it's a really different boundary. But the way, you know, that this has been integrated into society, and it's interesting to me that some of the recent research is suggesting the incidence, not just the ongoing prevalence, but the actual initial incidence of the crisis, you know, of voice hearing and, you know, the stuff that we consider to be schizophrenia, that may be going down in Lapland, because nobody knows why, but I imagine that it's because this has kind of pervaded the culture, that the acceptance and openness to voices, to the, you know, the things that we see as crazy or incomprehensible, the openness to hearing that has actually become widespread in the wider culture. So there is a very early help. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I think that in America, while we do value our privacy and the home is our castle, I think that people would be delighted if a warm, mm-hmm. friendly yes. psychiatrist, psychologist, or social worker said, you know, let me just come on in your home and sit with you folks. I mean, I think that their jaws would drop, that anybody cared enough.
Yes.
So I think it certainly could
I
work
here. I agree with
here.
You. I completely, because so many people are, say, I can't, you know, the person won't leave their room. And, you know, I've worked with people through a closed door. I remember being so, you know, I was so moved with one family that the second time I came, a parent had put a chair next to the door so that I could have a place to sit and talk through the door with someone. And people are frightened, you know, people are in so much distress, and the requirement that they have to travel, come, you know, maybe get a bus or, you know, get their car running and come to some office somewhere and go into a big building, and it's overwhelming. And I agree with you. I think that is very welcome and very supportive, and many people would be fine with that, knowing that this wasn't an examination, this wasn't a monitoring. It was just help and listening and being understood.
You know, I also think idea. It's probably very, yeah. I don't know if you have any data on this, I haven't seen any, but I think this is very cost effective. These people aren't getting hospitalized, they're not going on unemployment, they're not going on disability. All those rates are down. I mean, if people going on all those things are down.
If you know, if you save 30 years or more of someone on disability, that's a tremendous saving, cost savings, and in the long run, you know, this this is very, besides the savings in human suffering, all the people that this affects, besides, you know, in addition to the person who's going through the ordeal, you know, their families are in a lot of pain and worry, and so, you know, the initial Scandinavian project, the multi-site research, was called Needs Adapted Approach, and you know, it's a very important part of this. Is that we don't decide what other people need and give it to them. They look for what the person is asking for, and very often people are saying, "I can't come to you. You know, I can't do it." And we do need to go to the person, to the family.
Let me actually quote some rates from an article that you can easily find. You can just Google Open Dialogue, and it's an article by Jaakko Sikula and many others. And in the abstract, here are some of the rates for 2-year follow-ups involving 5 years of cases. So 2-year follow-ups over about five years of cases. 81% of the patients did not have any residual psychotic symptoms at 2 years. Now, no American psychiatric facility today would believe that. They don't even think they can get rid of psychotic symptoms.
Right.
They just drug people into submission. Now, 81% did not have any residual psychotic symptoms. And then this is mind-blowing. 84% had returned to full-time employment or studies. Now, a third of these people had used neuroleptic medication, but I believe it was quite short-term, and very few was it long-term. So this works. It absolutely 100% works, but it is contrary to the entire emphasis of the pharmaceutical industry and its partner, organized psychiatry. And it's just a tragedy what we're doing to people. We're making people chronic. There's a new study out that just came out that people on antipsychotic drugs lose cortical substance in their brains. Their cortexes shrink, and it's related to the amount of neuroleptic, and it happens on both the older ones and the newer ones. This is an incredible tragedy.
And people are still coming to me and saying, "My doctor said that the psychosis will cause the brain damage." And, you know, I have to tell them that research has not been, they weren't able to replicate it, and the, you know, the latest information is that it's the medication that is probably having that, you know.
Well, since the medication does it to people, it does it to animals, we know that in studies.
Yes.
There's no question about it.
Yeah,
it's so crazy. The profession is at this point so corrupt. Well, by the way, folks, I don't usually mention my radio media, but tonight I'm the resident psychiatrist on George Norrie's Coast to Coast here in the U.S. and in Canada, and it goes on at 10 o'clock on the West Coast, which means I have to be up at 1 a.m. tonight, which is not unusual for me actually. And the subject tonight, for 5 minutes, probably at about anywhere between a minute or two after 1 a.m. East Coast time, 10 p.m. in the West. Very soon after Sarah's show, I usually come on. And just for 5 minutes, I'm going to talk tonight about why there's such a shortage of psychiatrists, why psychiatrists, my medical students, are not going into psychiatry. And I'm going to be very hard-hitting about it because I think that if we had this kind of programs, medical students would flock into psychiatry. If we had programs that were human, caring, and worked, but who's going to go into a profession that just poisons and shocks people and can't show it helps? Yeah. So I'm going to talk about that tonight on Coast to Coast. That's on your major, whatever your major local talk station is, George Norrie will be on that. So this is all
there were advocates in my training class that were talking with National Institute of Mental Health, the people that were making decisions about what kinds of work or interventions to pilot in the United States, and talked with them for a good while, all through our training, I think. You know, there were people so enthusiastic about what we were learning, and talking with NIM, and at the end of this, the response of National Institute of Mental Health was that they could believe in dialogue. They could see, you know, sort of the research. They were trained to read research, and of course, understand this is what they do, but that it was too different for the U.S. It was too different for us to be able to utilize. And they have since decided to invite proposals. You know, that was a couple of years ago. But since then, they are looking at research proposals to pilot dialogue here. It's being piloted and tested in private sector with, you know, foundation funding, but in grant funding, but not by National Institute of Mental Health. And this is something that, to really be as effective as it has been, to hope to have that kind of impact, it does need to have government support. And, you know, it is a community-wide method. It involves and integrates systems, all of the systems. You know, it does not just provide one little bit of an angle here and call it mental health. It is more holistic and needs the support of, you know, something like at a governmental level. So I'm very glad that NIM will be looking at proposals to pilot it here. But we wondered, who is this too different for? You know, it was not too different for the 28 people that were getting the training. We were just had been looking for this ourselves, you know, for years and decades, some of us. And it wasn't too different for the families that we were working with at all. You know, they were very happy with it. So it kind of begs the question, you know, who is this not? Who's not happy?
I never heard that before, Rebecca, but it just so fits with the callous indifference of the psychopharmaceutical complex. Mm-hmm. You know, in this country, maybe the biggest difference between here and Europe is we are utterly dominated by the psychopharmaceutical complex, so much so that the drug companies make almost all their money by selling at outrageous prices in this country, which the government encourages under Obamacare, and sets no limits on. And so the companies just have a field day going through the government insurance programs with no monitoring. And so we're just dominated here by the pharmaceutical industry. And the domination is less. It's still strong, but it's less overseas. And that's the difference between the two cultures, is we're dominated by the drug industry in cahoots with the medical people.
Yeah, yes. Well, shall we talk about what dialogue is like? Because I think people would be very interested to know kind of the, on the ground, what this dialogue is about.
Take a breath. Take a breath and do that in a minute. And mm-hmm. Usually, folks, we have a break at 4:30, but we don't need to, and I'm not going to take a break today. But I will use the opportunity to remind you again about this wonderful Danish program that is taking place on September 16th, Wednesday, September 16th. It's my understanding they still have some spots. I mentioned to you that I'm going to be Skyping live, which I think will be very interesting. They have a good hookup, big screen. And Robert Whitaker is going to be there. Peter Gercha, who is just this incredible researcher in the field. He's got a new book, Deadly Medicines. You can look him up at deadlymedicines.dk. And I forgot to mention earlier that some people that I really admire a lot are going to be there giving personal accounts of patients driven into suicide by antidepressant drugs and into other destructive behavior. And Matthew Downing, who's a really good colleague of ours, and I was involved in her lawsuit, which was settled with the death of her daughter by suicide on antidepressants. She's going to be there, and a whole bunch of other people talking about the experiences of how bad things, how wrong things can go on the antidepressant drugs. But the conference itself will be about all the drugs. Let me just give you a little more, because I hope you get a few people from Europe who, you know, call your friends and email your friends and tell them about this. And again, if you go to Bregan.com, you'll see it is the final note on my selected highlights of Dr. Bregan's work at the top. And it says speaking by Skype to major Danish public meeting, September 16th. And you'll go to that, and Bob Whitaker is going to talk about the psychiatric drug epidemic in a historical overview. Peter Gertz is going to talk about why few patients benefit and so many are harmed. Then Bob's going to talk about changing the child instead of the environment. This is the wrong approach. Peter Gertz, which I'm so happy to see, is going to talk about a psychiatry without forced admission. And he's going to say this is a must. You just can't have forced admission and still be doing therapy. And I think, I imagine he'll say, it's going to corrupt the whole field. And then all these nice folks, Matthew Downing, Wendy Dolan, Stephanie Lynch, Leona Fennell, Kim Witczak, they're all going to be talking about issues of people harmed by the antidepressants. And then I'm going to be Skyping for 45 minutes about chronic brain impairment and psychiatric drug withdrawal. And I'm actually just going to talk about all the important things I can think of. And then there's going to be a lengthy question and answer live with me. So folks in Europe, you can get there and for 45 minutes talk to me about whatever's on your mind and ask questions of me. So, and the program goes from 9 to 5. Actually, it goes from 8:30 sharp till 5 closure. So look it up on my website and go up to Peter and say, hey, Peter, the other Peter sent me. I'd love you to do that. Now, we're going back now to Rebecca Hatton's ID. And if you missed the very opening of the show, Rebecca is one of the very unusual and special psychotherapists who works with psychotic people. And she's been trained in the open dialogue method. You can just look up open dialogue. It's the most proven approach to helping people with their first acute psychotic break. Absolutely the best proven program. And it's essentially a multidisciplinary family therapy and intervention in the home when possible, right in the home. Just folks open, friendly, kind, loving, talking together about the problems in the family. Rebecca, pick up on what you wanted to pursue.
Yes. So, you know, dialogue has integrated a lot of roots. Obviously, family therapy narrative therapy is something that Mary Olson, the American dialogic practitioner, has brought in, because we work with so many people who have chronified situations. You know, we're not meeting people usually 3 weeks in or 3 months. We are seeing people after they've been struggling for a couple of years or 10 years or longer. And narrative therapy is a type of family therapy often that is sort of tailored for long-standing, you know, serious issues. It does have very deep psychodynamic roots. And I think you'll be talking with Bert Caron next week, and you'll be able to hear a lot of, you know, he is my supervisor now, and I hear when I'm looking at dialogue, when I'm talking with Bert, it's, you know, there's just so much that echoes back and forth. Bert did go to Finland to meet with Jaakko and his colleagues when they were developing open dialogue. And Jaakko says that Bert affected him very much in his work. And I can hear a lot of Bert in the dialogic process. If people are familiar with relational psychoanalysis, sort of the relational turn, rather than classical, you know, analytic method, in which the therapist is quite remote and fairly silent and unknowable, a blank screen, that's a gross simplification and probably a terrible description of classical analysis. But relational analysis is very much parallel. It is the sort of the individual therapy analog of open dialogue family therapy. The idea that that human beings are created in community. We are not a self except in relation to other people. A recovered person I know put it in the terms of, you are not a therapist until I say you are. You know, the people we work with, our therapy partners, are the people, they make us therapists into, you know, if we want to be helpful, they enable us to be helpful. It's a two-way, you know, it's a circular process. Dialogism is a philosophy, which I think it's very interesting that it was developed by Mikhail Bakhtin, whose entire working life was spent under Soviet rule. So he lived under very strict censorship and a culture that, you know, essentially psychotherapy or anything like psychotherapy was illegal. It was impossible. But he developed these ideas of, oh, for example, we know ourselves by seeing ourselves reflected in another person's eyes. We come to know ourselves. There are things that we can't possibly see about ourselves. We need each other to see that in us. And he talks about being very embedded. You know, there's no such thing as a single person in a lot of ways. So these are some of the things that fed dialogue and the, you know, the ideas were combined in this synergistic way to create what dialogue is. And I believe that the recovery movement in the United States will be an essential key part of, you know, including the voices of people who have recovered, will be a really important part of American dialogue. Some of the details of some of the elements of what it is about, you know, listening for the many, many voices in the room, not looking for consensus, not looking to, you know, find some ultimate mystical truth. You know, we can't really understand each other much less somebody who is in a spiritual emergency or, and I, you know, maybe another way of looking at the world, if we insist that it fits into our pre-existing frame, you know, the beliefs we already have. So it's always open to, you know, and some ideas that people have are very difficult to hear. People get very angry. There's violence, and your latest book, Peter, is right about, you know, we are angry. We are aggressive at times, and this is something that needs to be heard. It needs to be listened to and understood. The idea that it's a basic existential need to be heard, being heard and being, you know, if you can remember being in really dire straits and in a lot of distress, the times we've been in the most shreked out kind of distress place, what it feels like to be heard at that time. It's very healing. And I guess if you're tend to be a guilty person, it feels like forgiveness. Or if you're an angry person, it feels like some justification. But those are very, it is very reassuring. And turns out in psychosis, it's essential. There is a lot of, there's as much transparency as we can muster as therapists. People do not discuss clients or families outside of the family. There are not behind the scenes consults or phone calls. The Finns told us that if they are driving home from a meeting with a family and they still feel like, you know, somebody says, oh, but blah, 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 they still need to talk about the family, that the meeting was not long enough. You know, they strive to say what they need to say when they're with the family and don't have a lot of, you know, sidebars. Of course, it's very nonviolent, not wanting to even make presumptions about someone else, but always listening for more, wanting to hear more and understand more. It's been very, very helpful to me in my life to have the idea that if somebody says something that is aggressive or cruel or hurtful, to ask, you know, how did that idea come to you? And to sort of look into that more deeply. And to see where the person is coming from with that, just transforms this. You know, you don't have to be all defensive and angry in return if you can be curious.
Now, Rebecca,
you
don't have the opportunity, obviously, as you mentioned to me, to actually implement a program like this where you are in private practice in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes.
How are you bringing this into your private practice? And what's it like? And
well, I have had, yes, I start, I, one, I tried a, to search out colleagues that would be willing to work with me and have something like a dialogic team. But of course, I'm the only person trained. And the training is important, you know, because there's a lot of unlearning that's involved in the training as well. We are not professionals that come in to do an intervention or to fix a person or to fix a family. We are there just as listeners and responders, responding to what is presented. We don't have an agenda and a format and so on. And for, you know, I have a teammate who is a psychiatrist, And she does this. These are people, often colleagues who are interested in this, are later in their careers. So, you know, we don't have to worry about funding and so on. But I have found people that are just interested in seeing what dialogue is like, and they accompany me, and they kind of follow along with what they see. They are learning in the moment, which is challenging, but it is so helpful to me to have colleagues there, to have another set of eyes. They hear entirely different things than I hear. They can see things that I miss and overlook. And we, you know, an aspect of dialogue is, instead of professionals reflecting directly to the a family member, we will turn to one another and we'll just ponder and reflect among ourselves, between the people on the team are thinking aloud with one another. So the family sees what that is like, you know, what it's like to sort of think out loud without having to push one another into a certain view, to value one another, to hear. Maybe even when I say something, I don't even hear what I'm saying sometimes. I don't, I listen better to myself because my colleague can hear things that I'm not fully aware of. And, you know, dialogue does not talk about the unconscious or resistance or defenses at all. That is too something that is a bit pathologizing, to be that direct or even to think in those terms. But rather, we talk about things that we don't have words to say, we don't have words for yet. New ideas coming in, and new ways of seeing that are born in the dialogue, in the moment. A lot of times psychosis is something that has gotten stuck and it's gotten repetitive because of difficult, you know, real pain. And when we are in pain, we tend to kind of get tunnel vision sometimes. And so the team can sort of show how it is when it's not just me, you know, it's not just my one-track mind that is working with this, but we have a group. We have different ideas and thoughts. And sometimes they are harsh or negative or critical, and how, you know, we show the team can show the family sometimes how even something like that can be approached rather than shut down and pulled away from.
Rebecca,
yeah.
One of the things that I deal with a lot in therapy is childhood trauma. Where does that fit into it, which does cause what I believe are unconscious impulses and feelings and even hallucinations?
Yes.
How does that dealt with in your personally? What do you think about that? And how does open dialogue deal with trauma, especially childhood?
Yes. Well, I in my experience has been that the kinds of experiences that we call psychosis are echoing very difficult experiences that people have had in life. And sometimes the trauma is invisible. It is too much solitude or isolation or separation from one another. But nevertheless, it is something that has been very difficult, and it's been between people that the difficulty has come up.
More specifically, let's an open dialogue. I don't know, in your training, I don't know how much you've seen. We've both seen films of what goes on in Finland. I mean, how often does something come out like, well, my father has sexually abused me?
Very often.
Does come up. Okay.
That it does. That is the purpose of dialogue, is to get to the problems and the difficulties. It is the diametric opposite of a lot of our mental health approach, which is to suppress and move away and, you know, put on a happy face over difficulties and pain, emotional pain. And dialogue is very much about going toward it and helping with it and supporting it and listening and hearing about that, so that what we call symptoms are a form of language. It's a form of dialogue itself. We need to be able to understand it more clearly, so we're sure that we know what the person is saying and they find the words to say that. Mary Olson, our American teacher, talked about a dialogue that she took part in Finland, in the emergency room, where a young couple came in and met with a team. She, and I think Yako was part of this team, and a third person. And the young woman had been very, she was very suicidal and had lots of terrible voices that she was hearing. Within 20 minutes, her partner said to the team, "Do you think that it's important that I hit her sometimes?" And, he felt, and the team was able to take that up and talk about it with the couple and eventually talk with the young woman, about is this part of your difficulty? Is this a problem for you? And she became clear and said, yes, that is, she was isolated with this young man and then he had started abusing her and she had become psychotic as a result. And as part of that, cycle. But it was really striking to me that the young man was so comfortable in the atmosphere of that, of talking with the team. Within 20 minutes, he was able to admit that he had gotten out of control that way.
Yeah. No, that is a wonderful testimonial to it. Now, the problem we have in the U.S., for example, here in New York State where I am, is that if it comes up in therapy that a child is being abused, that's a reportable crime.
It's reportable if you believe that it is an ongoing danger. And a lot of times, of course, this work is with adult children in the family.
Yeah,
they are already over
18. Yeah, the issue is not then.
Which is still, they're still a vulnerable adult, and it's still reportable. Yeah. The answer is...
I don't think what you just said is accurate. Hang on.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hang on a second, Rebecca. I don't think what you just said is legally accurate. I do believe that if an official in various positions, for example, in New York State, but most places, is a teacher or a doctor or a healthcare provider of any kind.
Yes.
It's not up to us to judge whether it's ongoing. We have to report it.
Okay. And that,
would really inhibit that kind of activity.
It's maybe not a huge deal.
I think it is a pretty big deal, though.
Yes. Well, it is. This is the horns of dilemma that we are often thrust into in this work. It's certainly a very difficult issue.
And it is.
I think that the dialogical approach is to of course we realize we still don't gain anything by moving away from this the topic, and that reported or not, the family still has a difficulty. They have a difficulty that dialogue is very useful in helping with. So it's kind of a principle of dialogue, if you can say that it has principles. Some people disagree that we don't want anything as hardened as that, but it is an idea in dialogue that people should not be together if they cannot be peaceful, if they are having physical violence, that they should not be living together in that situation, and how to, you know, there's a lot of talk and talk around with each family member talking about how they can, you know, how they feel about solving this. You know, most people do not want to be hitting their kids or doing violence in their families. And it, you know, it's something that dialogue is a very supportive process. And one of the benefits of having a team is that there can be people who take, kind of not taking sides, but who can be especially tuned in to one or another family member, so that a family member has an ally in the team one way or another. If one team member really has difficulty with a family member, then there's somebody else on the team who usually finds it easier to be an ally of that person and to support them, you know, with this problem of the violence. How can, you know, how can we help with this and help you to feel so that you don't, you know, if you are angry, then you are hurting, you are in pain, and how can we help with that pain that is coming out in this way? It's another great plus in working, you know, with the team.
Yeah.
Is that you don't have
you
to
feel
be
really
on...
good about the training program with Mary Olson, it sounds like. How do people
mm-hmm.
get in touch
yes.
with them?
Pardon me?
How do people get in touch with that training program?
Mary's Institute, Mary and Yako, I should say, are the co-directors of the Institute for Dialogic Practice. This is in Haydenville, Massachusetts, just outside of Northampton. Northampton is kind of a nexus of a lot of recovery-oriented stuff, just by chance. But Haydenville is very close by, and she does the basic clinical training is about a year and a half, 32 workshop days in all, over the course of about a year and a half. You do need to be in Haydenville to have that training. Although she does do group training, she has done that in Boston area, perhaps in Vermont. I'm not sure. She's been going up to Vermont. But
Rebecca, we're coming
most
to
of
an
the training
end.
Is in Haydenville. Yeah.
Yeah. We're coming to an end. Do you want to give people a direct phone number or just a website? What would you like to do so they can get in touch with you if they want to see you as a therapist or just chat with you and meet you?
Well, you can look at my website, which is drrebeccahatton.com. Pretty simple. My last name is Hatton. And my phone number is 734-709-2183. And I would be glad to talk with anybody about, you know, how to get the training, what it's like, what it's involved,
how
to get
the
therapy.
Show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being on the show very, very much. And I look forward to having continuing dialogue with you over the coming years. Thank you.
Okay.